Beyond a billion statistics. So, let me give you a bit of a biographical preview of this work. So this guy, he insisted that we should look at this problem. And this guy is a heavyweight mathematician who said that this must be true, okay? That guy here is a PhD student in Leeds. He did some calculations and he said, that looks funny. And I think that's an important word to say before a discovery or something like that. And this guy said, you know, that's how it's done. Okay, so that's the main player in this work. Let me just give a brief review of anions and what they are. They are particles which appear, of course, as a collective, as an effective phenomena in materials in nature that we hope they appear in nature or in theoretical models. And they have exotic statistics. How is that possible? Let's look at it in three dimensions. If you take one particle around another, then this loop that is spanned is equivalent to this small loop. So I can continuously deform that loop to this one. Now this one can be continuously deformed to the trivial loop, like doing nothing at all. So the wave function, the evolution of the wave function at the end is exactly the same at the beginning. And this gives rise to the two possible statistics we can have in three dimensions, the bosons, where the wave function doesn't change at all, or the fermions, where the wave function gets a minus sign after one exchange and another minus sign after the second exchange. The full circulation has happened, and it came back to itself as we expected. Now, in two dimensions, things change dramatically. And indeed, a path like this is actually not equivalent to a path like that. So I could assign an evolution to the bigger, so the smaller path, of course, can be decomposed, is equivalent to the identity, like nothing happens. But the big one, not necessarily is identical to the smaller one. It belongs to a different class of paths. So the wave function belongs, I could assign a phase factor to it after it went around, okay? And that corresponds to a billion anions, or I could assign a whole unitary matrix, okay, that maybe my state has evolved to another state after I made this evolution. And that's what non-abelian anions are related to. I know that this concept comes a bit strange. The easiest way to make peace with it is to think that each particle, or these effective particles, are actually composite particles of some flux going perpendicularly through your two-dimensional plane. And a ring of charge, okay? Now, if this particle goes around that particle, this charge goes around the flux of this one. So, of course, you get a phase factor, okay? And this is the Aharonov-Bohm effect. Now, you could imagine you have more complex charges and more complex fluxes, like non-abelian ones, and that will give rise to non-abelian effects, non-abelian evolution, unitary here. So, and this picture is actually pretty accurate. Now, anions come in two-dimensional systems, but there are different systems that they could support them. For example, you could have continuum systems. Electrons live on a continuum surface, and superconducting electrons, in the presence of a very strong magnetic field. That's the fractional quantum Hall effect. And there's a big technology, experimental, theoretical, related to it. Or there are lattice systems, either of spins, or electrons, or Majorana fermions, or bosons, that actually, with certain interactions, they can exhibit topological behavior. And I'm very fond, so there is a big, a number of people who worked lately on that. There's Kitayev mainly. Then Wen, Yoffe, Friedman, Ajax, Stengel, Hector, as we saw earlier on, and so on. And I like a lot the lattice models because they're exactly solvable, or you could solve them, okay? You can track them analytically. something that you don't quite have in the quantum Hall effect. You have more assumptions type of arguments. Now, what are anions? They are quasi-particles, okay? You have a substrate, another system on the background, and anions, which is in a certain state, and anions emerge as collective effects, okay? So collective effects were introduced by Landau, who was a member of the, enthusiastic support of the Communist Party. And he was quite amused when he introduced collective effects that became very popular. And they were used by his American colleagues as a terminology. So now you could find why you call them particles, because you have local operators to define them, okay? So if you say that I have a local operator, either energy or anything else, that can tell me where this particle is, where this excitation or effect is, then I can call it a particle. Also, I need to be able to move them with local operations. So that's very important, okay? Then the concept of particle appears, effective, of course. And in order to be able to, I can trivially think of such ways, like I have a lattice of spins, unentangled, and then I rotate the spins. If all the point up, I'm in a vacuum. If one points down, I have an excitation, I have a particle, then I can move this excitation around and nothing happens. And that's fine. That's just a boson, actually, what you had there. But if you want to have an anion, okay, you need more complex states on the background. And imagine that you have a big entanglement sitting on the background of spins. Then by local operations, I can make such an evolution and eventually have non-trivial evolution. So the anionic statistics is actually possible due to entanglement of the underlying system. That's a very safe statement to make. And the more complex the anionic system you want to make, the more complex the underlying state has to be. Just to motivate a little bit the presentation I'm going to give now is Kitayev's honeycomb lattice model. So he said, take a lattice, a honeycomb lattice, and put some very simple interactions. And for different couplings of your interactions, the model behaved either as an abelian, the so-called toric code model that we will see in detail in a minute. It has four particles, a vacuum. The vacuum is also called the particle, a charge, a flux, and a composite, which actually behaves as a fermion. This is very well understood. And also, if you change slightly the coupling constants, the emerging theory which comes out is a non-abelian anionic model, the so-called Ising model. It has a vacuum. It has a psi, which is like a fermion, very similar to the epsilon. But sigma is now a non-abelian anion. Okay, it has this non-abelian properties as a complex object. And this theory is not well understood. People haven't really managed to put their hands on it, right? To write it, to see how it actually explicitly emerges. And this is a topic of our work, how actually we can connect these two. So what we would like to do is to obtain this model out of more complex manipulations on the toric code system substrate, if you like. And in a sense, we will see what is non-abelian anions, what is the characteristic which makes it non-abelian. So let me take a small tour of the toric code model. This is an error-correcting code. It's a stabilizer formalism defined, and it's very beautiful to understand. What is not beautiful is a Hamiltonian, okay? So imagine you have a lattice. Yeah, I mean, when I first saw this Hamiltonian, so it was Angelo Carollo in my office mate at that time, and he told me, okay, toric code model, you have these four spin interactions. He wrote it down, and I took me about half a year to get over it and come back to topological models. But actually simple, and I'll explain you. I hope I'll manage to give you the beauty of it. Imagine you have qubits or spins on a square lattice, and they sit on the vertices. Okay, that's one version of it. And I bicolor the plaquettes as P and S, okay? And in alternating chessboard fashion. And on the P plaquettes, I assume that the four spins on the P plaquettes interact by a Z, 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 Z interaction, okay? And on the S plaquettes, they interact as X, 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 X interaction. It's very easy. It's like Ising interactions are Z, Z between two spins. Now you have four of them, if you like, interacting all together. So I have these two different types of interactions. And yeah, that's a reference. Now, this Hamiltonian, actually, these interactions, actually, they have very nice properties, if you forget the higher order. First of all, they're square to one. And each of those terms commutes with a Hamiltonian. Each interaction term of a plaquette commutes with a Hamiltonian. You can see that Z commutes with other Zs, but because they're Zs. But also, the Zs commute with the Xs, because at most, they have two neighbors. Okay, and Z with X anti-commutes, two Zs and two Z Xs commute. So the Hamiltonian commutes is zero. So I have very good quantum numbers to describe the spectrum of this Hamiltonian, and they are just the eigenstates of the X operators at each plaquette now, or of the Z operators, they will be a plus or minus one. These are Hermitian, the square to one. Moreover, okay, that comes the beauty of it, is that the x's and the z's commute, as we said, which makes the Hamiltonian exactly solvable. I can write down the ground state. I can write down the full spectrum of it, OK? So if you like, its complexity gives me this possibility to. And indeed, the ground state is written as simple as that. I put zeros everywhere, and I know that this zero actually minimizes the energy of this term. Okay, I have Z, so that will become the eigenvalue of zeros for this interaction is one, with a minus sign is minus one, and I have a sum of minus ones, so it's the lowest it could go. And I need to project to make it an eigenstate of this with eigenvalue one again. So I project with the operator one plus X's for every S plaquette. So every S plaquette has this operator in front assigned. And if I act with X is here, then this is just symmetric and this eigenvalue plus one. And this is a ground state. Right. So and you can see that actually this minimizes the whole thing. You can easily convince yourself because I guess these are usual techniques people use in the error correction codes. But in the context of the Tori code, it was given that reference. Well, that's one ground state. Yeah, I'm thinking only of planar case and boundary conditions that are fixed. So I have one ground state. I could have more if I had different topology. The excitations, actually, of this model, they're given by in the following way. I take the ground state, and I perform X rotation or a Z rotation, okay, on a certain qubit. So if I, for example, if I perform on the ground state a Z rotation here, then the final state will have, will anti-commute with the plaquette operators of XXX, which live on the S plaquette, okay, and the XXX, which lives here. And thus, you will increase the energy of those plaquettes, okay? So, and then these I call actually an anion. I call my excitation, my quasi-particle. I have an operator which I apply XXS here, and will anti-commute with this, will give me a minus one as an eigenvalue on this state. And also the same if I do an X rotation, of course it will commute with the S because these are X's, but it will anti-commute with the Z's. So I assign on these guys here the concept of a particle of a collective excitation. There is nothing on the plaquette inside here. Just that I have an operator, okay, a plaquette operator, which has a different eigenvalue than the vacuum, what I call the vacuum, And that's what I call an anion. What is generated by Z rotations, I call it an M anion. And what is generated by X rotations, I call it an E anion. So the M's live on S plaquettes, as we see here, and the E live on P plaquettes, as we see there. Now, these anions, these excitations, or these quasi-particles can be easily moved around. So if I perform another X rotation here, I will create one, two, I will change the eigenvalues of this one. But the plaquette here will have two minus signs coming from the two rotations I performed, so it will go back to plus sign. So the excitation or the occupation here will go away and it will be generated here. So by applying a string of X's, okay, I can move the anions, and I know the anions are right at the endpoints of these strings. Okay. So now let's see about the statistics, how the statistics comes about of these anions. Let's take an E anion, which is assigned as blue here, and we move it around an M anion, okay, which is, for example, this one here. And this I can do by a string of X rotations. Perform an X here, another X here, another X here, and another X here, okay? So now this corresponds to moving one anion around the other, okay? So the initial configuration was my vacuum with an X rotation here, which created this pair, and a Z rotation there, which created this pair. The final state after I perform these operations, after I move the anion around the other, is performing X, 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 X on this 1, 2, 3, and 4, okay, here. And the only thing to remember, to have in mind, is that there is a Z one here, and there is an X one there. This psi initial we substitute in, and we see that this operator actually anti-commutes with that operator, so I can bring it forward, and I will acquire a minus sign, okay? And now this XXX acting on the vacuum give me, again, the vacuum, okay? Because the vacuum was built up to have eigenvalue plus one with respect to all these operators here. So what I'm getting is a minus sign, okay? So after I eliminated the path, I acted it on the vacuum, commuted it through the paths, and acted on the vacuum, I get the initial state as I had before, only with an overall minus sign, okay, in front of it. And this reveals the anionic statistics, the mutual anionic statistics between the E and the M, okay? This E and M are not the same particles, okay? They're different, but they can have non-trivial statistics between them. Now, how do you actually see that is anionic? So we had the full circulation. Full circulation is actually equivalent to two successive exchanges. So if the two successive exchanges equal to minus one, the braiding, the exchange of them, gives you an I factor. So things are rather intriguing here. But an anion is not one or minus one, it's I. Now, you can view this circulation of this guy around this one in another rather different way. You can consider that the composite particle of an E and an M, okay? If I think that this is a composite, a unified thing, okay, object and a composite particle, then the circulation of this one around that means it's equivalent to actually rotating the composite object by 2 pi, by 360 degrees. So this composite object, when it's rotated by 2 pi, gets a minus 1 phase. And of course, that's exactly what a fermion should do. Fermion has spin half. If I rotate it by 2 pi, I will get a minus sign. I have to rotate it by 4 pi to come back to the same wave function. So that actually, exactly that, reveals the fermionic statistics of the epsilon, which is defined as a composite of one E and one M particle. Let me list the characteristics we saw so far, all the characteristics of the toric coat anionic model. This is an abelian model. It has four particles, the vacuum, E, which is abelian, M, which is abelian, and epsilon, which is a fermion. Now, when I say abelian, I mean this with that has abelian statistics. This with that has abelian. This with that has abelian. This with himself, another M particle, is actually just a boson. So they have trivial statistics with himself, but non-trivial with any other non-trivial particle here. Well, this is actually a fermion, as we saw. Now, there is another property that topological model satisfies called fusion, which means what happens if you put two of those particles together and you consider them as a unified particle. This is like a change of basis. This is like a tensor product, if you like, of spins. But mainly you take the two excitations or quasi-particles and you consider it as one. You don't react them. You don't need. So an M with an M gives you one, all right? And that's equivalent of you make, as we saw earlier on, you make an X rotation here on the same plaquette and another X rotation on the same plaquette. I was supposed to have occupation of two anions on the same plaquette, but this actually gave me the vacuum, okay? The eigenvalue of the ZZZZ operator was back to plus one. And the same happens if I do that with the E's. Now, if I compose an E and M, I get the epsilon, which is a fermion. Because an epsilon has already an E and an M, if I fuse it with another E, I will get M, and so on and so forth. Okay, as we see here. So you get all these fusion rules describing your topological model. What about the braidings? So we saw that the epsilons behave as fermions. You can actually rotate them, as we did earlier on, or you can actually exchange two fermions, and you see actually you get the minus one. It's a very nice exercise. So how this comes about as well. Also, we saw that E with M, if I exchange them twice, if I braid them, I get the minus one sign. And also, it's easy to convince yourself that E with E gives you one, the exchange of two E's is one, and exchange of two M's is one. Basically, they're all made out of Z's only, so there is not anything interesting out of their commutation. Now, there is another property that topological models have, which is interesting, and that has to do with the fusion non-commutativity, okay? And easy to simply put, is like that. If I have a pair of four anions, and I know that this one with that one, the fuse to the vacuum, that's why I call this E and this E bar, which is the antiparticle, the anti-anion, I know the fuse to the vacuum, and these two fuse to the vacuum. Now, if I decide to fuse them horizontally, then I don't know what will happen if I fuse these two. In this particular model, they fuse back to the vacuum, okay? So, but this is exceptional for this abelian for abelian models. So, in general, I have non-commutativity. If I fuse this way, I don't get the vacuum. So it means that I get the vacuum if I fuse that, but if I fuse this way, I get something else. Here, I don't get something. I get again the same thing. Okay. So actually, this general non-commutativity in our case is just commutativity of fusion. And that's all about the toric coat. Okay.
You're fusing different particles, right? So why would you expect it to be the same?
Yeah, you will expect to get something else.
I mean, but if you fuse them this way and then fuse them this way, you'll get the same thing. If you fuse them this way and then this way, right? That would be.
Yeah, so let me write it down a little bit more explicit. So basically, the property is that if I have A, B, C, and D, then the in between, what I get in between can be written as a sum over J of actually fusing A, B, and C, and a sum over, and then there is a matrix here, C, and I have I and J, if you like. So while I is fixed, I have a certain outcome after fusing
two onions, and it is the same outcome after I fuse this one. In our case, it's one, the onion one. If I decide to fuse B and C now, which means that I do it transversely here, I get here, I don't get the one, I get something else. So this is what I call non-commutativity.
Okay, sorry. If you're fusing with the antiparticles, even in the general case, do you still get?
No. So, I mean, I put that antiparticle here, it's E again. Okay, because it's antiparticle of itself. So I just wanted to clarify. Maybe it's more confusing. So if I fuse this E with that E, I get one. If I fuse this with that, I get also one. So it's a commutativity in the fusion operations, if you like. Okay, I've used a little bit of language here. Thank you. Let's see now what the topological properties. How much more time do I have? Sorry for that. Thank you. Let's see the topological properties of the Ising model. This is a non-abelian model, okay? So let's just list them here. So what first you do is you state the different types of particles you have, okay? I have a vacuum, I have a sigma, which is my non-abelian onion, and I have a psi, which is a fermion. Second, I state what the fusion rules are. And here comes, this is the interesting fusion rule. The sigma onion, if I fuse it with another sigma onion, I have two different channels, okay, of outcomes. One is I go back to the vacuum, or after you made the fusion, you might go back to psi, okay? So this, that you have the possibility of two different outcomes signals that you have non-abelian onions. Okay, that's a unique characteristic of them. Abelian ones always have one outcome on the other side. Okay? And in order to make yourself a little bit more comfortable with that, think about tensor product of two spin half particles. I could get symmetric sector, so the anti-symmetric is zero, or I could get a one. And that's exactly what you get here. You might get, yes, please.
Can show easily that if there's only one
channel, if and only if it's a billion. Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's. So, I mean, actually, you will see here why the non-abelian has to use it by construction. So if I fuse a sigma with a psi, I get again a sigma. So, sigma might have a psi in it or not, and that actually might indicate a little bit what's going on here. And also psi with a psi give me the vacuum back, okay? And that's what I expected. That's easy to satisfy. We had it also on the Torrey code. Now let's see the braiding properties. And I'll take modulo some phase factors, which are very important, but I will not describe them here. I will not reproduce them here. So the braiding is a psi with a psi, these are fermions, the fused to one, so that's what this means. This symbol means that I braid two epsilons, they come back to one. It's given by this matrix. Unbraided. Okay, so this matrix describes me what comes out. So that's what R is. Okay, so psi, psi, and if, of course, if I exchange them, I get a minus one. If I exchange two sigmas, which they have a fusion channel to one, okay, then I get, if I exchange them twice, okay, so I have a double exchange, I get a one. But if the fusion channel is psi down here, then the monodromy, which is twice the exchange, is minus one. Yes, please.
The meaning of R, sigma, sigma, each of these things, it's a number.
Yeah. So I could build up a matrix out of this,
right,
which would be diagonal.
How do you get from that situation twisting to a physical meaning?
Pardon? So, I define these numbers in that way.
Yes.
Yes, I define these numbers just by if the state of this and the state of that, they're related with this R, which is a number, yes.
Now, if psi was a sigma, if I exchange them, they will fuse only to a sigma. And if I exchange them twice, I get again a minus one phase. So we'll see. So that's the properties I have. And there is an overall phase factor in front of these two guys that I'm ignoring. The relative phases are fine. Now, here comes a fusion non-commutativity,
which is a non-Lambdian characteristic. So if I fuse a sigma with a sigma in that way, and I get the vacuum, okay, I know the fusion channel of these two and the fusion channel of these two. How could I know that? Well, I could create them out of a pair creation out of the vacuum, and I know that if I reverse the process, I go back to the vacuum. So I create two sigma anions here, I create two sigma anions there, and now, okay, I rotate by pi over two, and I try to fuse them that way. And if you do that, then you will see that what you get is actually 1/√2, I'll get with probability 1/2, I'll get the vacuum, and with probability 1/2, I'll get the fermion out of it, okay? So by exchange, so I had this relation where now I have more possibilities out here because my anions had different fusion channels. I'm allowed to have more possibilities. So another possibility is if I fuse this with that and I get a fermion, okay, and this with that and I get a fermion. Now, if I try to do it transversely, I get exactly the same with the minus sign in front. So, and then you can see that you can build this Fij to be a matrix, okay? This is a 2x2 matrix, which is basically a Hadamard, okay? And these are the characteristics of the Ising non-Abelian model, which I will try to reproduce with what we saw on a spin lattice. I mean, the question is that what really is going on the spin lattice, okay? How could I represent all these properties? Okay, that's a question I'll try to answer today. We will try to find a representation of the Ising model out of the Torrey code, okay? First of all, I will try to represent the particles. I have these three particles. Psi is a fermion, and naturally, as you might naturally think, I can identify it with a fermion of the Torrey code, the epsilon here. Okay, so I have a product of X and Z strings representing my fermion, and that's fine. What about the sigma, which is a non-Abelian anion? Well, first of all, let me make a parenthesis. I'm only thinking in terms of strings. So I have a string, and at the end points, I have my my anions, my excitations, okay, my quasi-particles. Now, what a sigma string would be is a superposition of a string of epsilons and a string of, a string of E's and a string of M's. So let me denote this as like that. So a string of sigmas, which I have a sum operator, sigma 1, sigma c, okay? So, which belongs in the Clifford algebra in general, acting on the vacuum we saw earlier, basically is a string of c's, which is, I think, produced by x's, plus or minus a string of M, which is produced by Z, normalized acting on the vacuum side, okay? So, and this, if you like, graphically, is either you have a string of Z's with the M's on the endpoints, or you have a string of X's, which are E at the endpoints, okay? Now, the endpoint, I circulate it, I call it a new particle, okay? And that would be my sigma particle. If I had an operator, I would see that here, there's only one excitation, one quasi-particle, either of that type or of that type. Also, I have a superposition here of strings, but in a background medium, okay, of which is entangled medium, if you like. And this superposition comes out as an entanglement because I have an invariance on the shape of the string. I could have any shape in this string I like. That's a topological characteristic. And that will give me exactly the same state at the end after I acted on the ground state, as long as I keep the endpoints fixed. So I can actually forget the string, and I have a superposition here, like an EPR state, if you like. Because if I measure this and I find an E here, I know there will be an E here. And if I measure an M, I know it will be an M. So if you like, this is like entanglement coming out of superposition, okay, of non-local objects. And that's a little bit what's going on here. The non-local information is actually the sign of the superposition, either a plus sign or a minus sign. The amazing thing is that these endpoints can be moved by local operation. I need some controlled operations, of course, and I can move this anywhere I like, step by step, okay, without destroying the superposition. So I use some control operations on the plackets, and I make a rotation. I can extend the strings, and I can keep the superposition. I can keep the plus or minus sign unknown. Well, I can find out what this plus and minus sign is if I bring these onions close together, and then I make a local operation around them. Then I know what this will be. But as soon as I keep them, as long as I keep them far apart, this is hidden information. So, and then I can move them with local operations, local objects, so I can call them particles or quasi-particles. Next thing we will look is the fusion, and it comes together with the fusion non-commutativity, okay? For that, let's consider two strings, one here of this sigma onions, and another one there. In position, the sigmas are in position 1 and 2, and in position 3 and 4. And I write these strings in that form, acting on the vacuum state. Now, if I expand this this product, this as we saw, this is a string of x's or a string of z's, and I have two of those, actually, I can take the product of them. And what I get is a state like this. And j tells me if this string, the superposition is with a plus sign, if j is plus, or with a minus sign if j is a minus. I take the j's to be equal for the two strings. Now, if I make the product, I get e's on all four positions, or m's on all positions, or e's on here and m's on the other one, or m's on this side. And so basically what I do is I bring them together, and I call them a new particle, okay? I put them in one box, if you like, and I want to see what are the statistics of this box, what's the behavior of this box. Now, you can easily convince yourself that if I fuse them now transversely, the 1 and the 3, E with E gives me the vacuum, and also M with M's give me the vacuum. So this state here can be identified with an overall vacuum. If I come here and I fuse 1 with 3 and 2 with 4, I see that I get in this position a fermion and in this position another fermion. And the same thing here, I get in this leg. So that's why I split them in that way. So basically, this whole state is a fermion. Psi here, epsilon here, epsilon here. And this is exactly the fusion channel we saw earlier on, okay? That, so let me maybe go back to it. So you can reproduce, if you fuse them that way, the other give you plus sign if the J was plus, or a minus sign, 1 plus the psi, that's it, 1, 2 ones plus the psi. And the sign here, J plus or minus, tells you the initial channel, fusing channel of these two. If J is equal to 1, they fuse to the vacuum. If J equals to minus 1, they fuse to a fermion. Okay, so here we obtain the fusion non-commutativity. Now, let's see about the braiding, which is also a very interesting property. Well, if I exchange tube size, I get a minus sign. This we demonstrated earlier on. If I exchange a psi, if I take a psi around the sigma, okay, I have this superposition here. And then I have a psi here with another psi. If I take this around here, and this is a sigma, then here I have either an E or an M, okay? So if I take a psi around an E, I get a minus one sign. Or if I take it around M, I get a minus sign. Here I have always one particle. This is a property I have. Either will be E or M. They're in superposition. So this rotation will give me a minus sign. And that's a property coming out from the toric code. Please.
Label, this two-state label, like one identity. I wonder what reasoning you have behind the label, like in the end here?
This is a vacuum. So this is a vacuum state. So E with E fuses to the vacuum, and M with M fuses to the vacuum. So this state actually tells me that in these boxes, I have vacuums. So that's what it means. Yeah, when I fuse them, 1, 3, and 2, 4. Now if I fuse this 1, 3, and 2, 4, I get epsilon, epsilon, or epsilon, epsilon. So that's it. So, and now the interesting part comes, what happens if I, what are the braiding of two sigmas, actually, okay? So I have sigma, sigma, when they fuse to a vacuum channel, I should get one, when they fuse to psi channel, I should get minus one. So let's take this configuration as we have here, we take out the strings and we move the three around the one, okay? So let's see now what's the final state we got. So I had these sigmas. Let me expand them as we did here. That's exactly the same state we had before. This is a vacuum, and this is a psi. I perform the braiding. So if you perform the braiding, basically what you do is you take the three particles around the one, OK? So now if I take the three around the one, in this state, I get exactly the same because these are bosons. The M3 around the M1, the bosons, I get the same. The M3 around E1, I get the minus sign because these are anions. And the E3 around M1, I get a minus sign. So basically, the plus sign became a minus one, okay? And that's the characteristic I wanted. When these sigma particles diffuse to the vacuum, okay, I get no phase factor, no phase change. When these sigma particles, they're in the channel which fuses to a fermion, as I have here, the sign changes from plus to minus, so I get this statistical property I have there. So we reproduce also the braiding, the braiding property. Okay, okay? So here comes the conclusions. How much time? Sorry. So first, it's possible to reproduce these properties only at looking at the S topological matrix. Okay, the topological S matrix is basically the amplitude, okay, or the expectation value of doing these operations, creating a pair of anions, a sigma sigma bar, and here you create another pair of anions, like the vacuum and the vacuum bar. Then you braid them, and then you fuse them. And then you ask, what is the amplitude of going back to the vacuum, okay? Reproducing the vacuum after this braid. I could have anion A and B, A bar, B, B bar, and then I will have the AB element of the sigma matrix there. But for the time being, I consider only that, okay? Now, you can see that the S matrix for the Ising model is a root of 2, and it can be reproduced out of a sum of the S matrices, a normalized sum of the S matrix of the toric code, okay? Which means if I write this in terms of a composite, in terms of the strings and the loops, that's a loop of E and a loop of M going around the vacuum and normalized by root of 2. So Actually, you can reproduce a full S matrix, topological S matrix, in that fashion by considering the superposition principle of strings. So that's another, if you like, intuitive reason why this works. What we have seen is that even if I use superposition of strings, this still belongs in the Clifford group. So it's a Clifford group representation of these non-abelian anions, okay, of the Ising one. Something that hidden under the carpet is a chirality issue. So basically, please.
Why is it root 2 in the end? So each of the terms.
So I have, yes, thank you. So basically, I have a loop of E's, so it's a loop of E's. If I have that on the vacuum, it gives me 1, because E's is like XXX, and 4, okay? If I act on the vacuum, it gives me again XXXX. So the eigenvalue of this operator is 1. So I have a 1 here, plus a 1 here, I have a 2 over root of 2, I get a root of 2. It's another weird, okay. So the chirality is a big issue here, and that's a problem that it hasn't been solved. It's a big question in condensed matter, how you could go from a non-chiral system to a chiral one. And we have, we propose actually a method how you can do it by using ancillary qubits and controlled operations, okay? But I don't have time to prepare, and this actually tells you that you get overall phase patterns if you make loop operations. If you make it a loop and you twist your particles around, you get non-trivial phases. And that has to do with chirality. It's a very interesting and important question. Now, the other thing is that how this could generalize to different models. Okay, what we saw here is we connected a topological model, a abelian topological model, which had 4 particles. So there is a concept such as the quantum dimension of the topological model. And for abelian ones, you just add the number of different particles you have. Each particle has topological dimension 1. So 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 for the 4 particles of the toricot gives you a topological dimension of the model. The total topological dimension being 4. Here is topological dimension squared is equal to 4. For the Ising model, you have only 3 particles. This has topological dimension 1. The sigma has topological dimension square root of 2. And you add them actually squared. And the psi is a abelian one, has topological dimension 1. So if you add them again, you get total topological dimension 4. And we were able to find a relation between these two because they had equal topological dimensions. It would be very intriguing how we could relate other models, topological models, with equal dimensions. One being simpler statistically, one being more complicated, but with less particles, with less total number of particles. How you could relate the two? So, and how you can relate is by increasing the degree of entanglement in your of your states. And for example, this state here is, I have the entanglement I had in my toricot state, but here I have an extra superposition of 2 different excitations, if you like. And that helped me to bring about the non-abelian behavior. Okay? So thank you for your attention.
Questions? Okay, I have the first question. Can you use this approach with non-lattice-based anion models?
Yes, there is Andy Stern and colleagues a few years back. They argued in a very similar way or in a parallel way how you could obtain from quantum Hall effect abelian, non-abelian statistics from abelian one. So basically, their title was non-abelian behavior from entanglement in abelian one, which is very interesting work, but it doesn't quite map one to one. So that's very interesting work. So
you mean
it doesn't map.
Well, it's in the continuum, the properties apply different, and here on the lattice, the properties apply different. So, it, but the there is a similarity in the idea. Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, no, it's a very, very stupid remark. Only, how did they approach this question? It's not a solvable model in the continuum. So how was their method of approaching the question?
So in the, when I say continuum, I mean actually thinking about the P-wave superconductor, and then you know what states you have and the ground states and excitations. And you manipulate these states and you get some. So we're not talking about the quantum hole effect. I mean, within the quantum hole community, people have models where similar things might happen. Thank you.
Can you relate this way of thinking the ions with a more abstract, the more abstract view with the Young-Baxter equation and the red group?
To relate them. Yes. So something we try to do, but it's mathematically more demanding. I think some of your ideas actually might be quite useful. Is to relate the topological S matrices, okay? And so you need to the topological S matrix has a fusion and the braiding properties already there. So if you could find such a relation between a simple model and a more complex one, that should be. So that's the surface. And these are matrices, and you have to take now composites of simple topological models like Z2, S3, and so on, and in a special special composites like with certain properties.
Okay, this was in the language of group. Do you think there is more or less in your this approach than in the more abstract view based on the bright group?
It's exactly the same.
This is exactly the
same. Yes, we try to reproduce all the properties. You don't need, if you build a theory, you don't need to reproduce everything. So you could actually reproduce the different types of particles. Or you try to reproduce the fusion rules. That's a very decent work you could do. Or you could try to, or, and after that, a more complex one is to reproduce the braiding properties. And finally, the most complex one is the statistics, the spin, the chirality to add it in. So, but you could actually go step by step. So there are like chiral algebras, there are quantum doubles, and they try to satisfy one by one these properties. And now we have an alternative, if you like, approach with Clifford group. Operations, how you could verify all these different properties.
Where are you starting from when you say you can prove these things? Like, are you talking about a mathematical model and you can show each of these?
So, there's a topological model is defined with anions. You first give the different types of anions you have, then the fusion rules, then the braidings,
sure.
Then the statistics. So, that these are you know, you can find different mathematical operators which have these properties.
Mm-hmm. And the difference is you're explaining that you can do some but not the other.
So you could. So I can give you some mathematical objects, all right?
Yeah, right.
That actually represent the particles, and they give me the fusion rules. But it doesn't mean that they satisfy the braiding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have to add something extra to satisfy the braiding.
Okay.
And then you have to add something extra, actually.
Yes.
We need something extra for the chirality. So
so just because you have a non-abelian topological model, it doesn't mean that you can do universal quantum computing just with braiding and fusion, as you know. So I've got a two-pronged question. First of all, is this Ising model one that enables you to get universal quantum computing or no?
No, this one will not enable, yes.
So my next question then is, what do you expect breaks down if you were to try to, you can choose non-abelian models that have a certain quantum dimension. Presumably you can find abelian models that have the same quantum dimension. If you were to try to simulate the non-abelian model with the abelian one in the same kind of idea, what do you expect would break down there that presumably it does break down because you wouldn't, you know, this would be a major result. So what do you have any expectations? Or maybe
actually the mapping is not one-to-one as such. If I want to reproduce chirality, I have to add some ancillas, some additional operations. So I'm not In that case, I'm going away from the Xi state, the Xi vacuum. I'm adding to the complexity of my states. Okay? And then this is a very important thing. Consistency of these topological models means that you have a number of particles, the fusion, the braiding, and the statistics there. Okay? So actually, I didn't put that, I didn't put the chirality in, but this is necessary there if you want to have a complete, consistent, unitary topological model. This statement will be slightly different. And that will add in the complexity.
So the chirality effectively is going to be the problem.
Yes, the chirality, or the consistency of the model, let's say, will make it actually be more complex than what. It's amazing that we could actually get that so simple. So. But the consistency needs another step.
May I just ask a little bit to that question?
Right. Right.
Yeah, listen, your answers to that question, you're focusing on what you do with chirality. The question is that whether you can have abelian operations, and through some operation you can produce a result of non-abelian. Do you mean to say that the difference between the two is only chirality?
Well, for this model, yes. For if you go to more complex ones, I haven't, we've tried, where it's work in progress, so I don't have an example of a universal model and an abelian model and the relation. I think that would be, it might not be, actually you might need to have a non-abelian and an abelian give you a more complex non-abelian one. And so the universality issue, it might mean that you can't go from a non-universal to universal. Actually, that's a very likely possibility, because we actually tried to get the SU2 level 4, this is 12 dimension 12, out of a Z2 cross Z2 cross Z3, which is purely abelian ones, and this didn't work, okay? So that might be an indication that this is not possible to go from, but maybe something like that is possible, to go from, you know, S3 to Z2 4.
But it's also something that you need to add on, similar to the chirality operation. Right?
Yes. So this step is all also there. That's my excuse for the moment why you could go actually from that. My indicator, you can go from a universal to a non-universal. The states are different. That we know. Now, how crucial that is, I don't know. If you,
yeah, to be very specific in case. Thank you.
Okay, so I think we've got lunch now, but I think before we go to lunch, Robert wanted to say a few things.
Yes, no, no.